Praise the Lord and good morning, Anchored family. We're so glad you're with us on this beautiful, beautiful Sunday morning. We've spent a wonderful worship session together, and now we want to learn from God's Word together. We are back to our chapter by chapter, verse by verse study through the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 14. We're picking up at verse 14, Revelation chapter 14, verse 14. Two Sundays ago, we took verses 6 through 13. There were three angels with three messages that are to be delivered at the halfway point of the seven-year tribulation. And this week, verses 14 through 20, there are another three angels. And everything that they will say and do in this chapter is to take place at the end of the tribulation, at the coming of Christ, the second coming of Christ. That makes this little section, verses 14 through 20, a parenthetical insert, or in keeping with the previous reference I made to the TV show Lost, it is a flash forward to the end of mankind's rule over the earth. This is when man's rule comes to a dramatic and climactic conclusion, and then the Lord takes over for good. I am very much looking forward to that day, as I know many of you are. Now, as told in verses 14 through 20, this will be illustrated with two different harvests. First, a grain or a wheat harvest, and then a grape harvest. Now, don't be confused by the two different illustrations. There won't be two different harvests at the second coming of Christ. There is only going to be one end time harvest. It's just that John sees two different harvests in order to help him properly communicate two very different aspects of this one end time harvest. Capiche? Does that make sense? I hope so. It is a powerful section because harvests make for powerful spiritual illustrations all throughout the Bible. And I should tell you, they're not always negative. Here's a good example. When Jesus was in Samaria with his disciples in John chapter 4, and he was recruiting his disciples to help him with evangelism to bring those Samaritans whose hearts were ready to their Messiah, to him, he compared that evangelism, that salvation of the Samaritans, to a wheat harvest. So in that case, wheat harvest, very good thing. But of course, more often than not in the scriptures, when we see this illustration of a harvest of any sort, usually it's used in a very negative way. And the meaning is always the judgment of God. It's an illustration that was destined to happen because of the uncanniness of the comparison. Mankind, just like produce, we spring up from the earth. We have life. We grow. And eventually we produce the fruit that we are going to produce with our lives, whether that is godly fruit or wicked fruit. But eventually, the day of cutting down comes to all, whether that is through your death or whether that is through this judgment at the end of the age. The fact remains, the cutting down of all of earth's fruit, all of the works of mankind for the purpose of judgment does come, and then we will be sorted and sifted according to our eternal destinations. That's what we're looking at today. It's only a cheery subject if your fruit is desirable to the reaper. And if not, then not so much. If you're not a true Christian that is producing true Christian fruit, then you might sit a little uneasy during this message. And if that's the case, when this message is over, then do what is necessary. Make things right. Come to Christ as your Savior, and I promise you, from that point forward, you will produce righteous fruit forever for the Lord. So let's get going with this. Revelation chapter 14, verse 14. Then I, the Apostle John, looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. We have to interpret this for what it is. It is a spiritual vision that was given to John. So we don't expect that when this event takes place, it will look exactly like this. It's explained in many different ways using many different illustrations. So we understand that the task is to take this section, understand it as an illustration, and take a look at any metaphor, any illustration, any symbolism that we find in this section, and then, of course, pull from that the truths that the Lord wants us to learn about end time prophecy. So with that said, we'll start with this, the phrase, the Son of Man. Now, some of this is repetition because we have covered some of this in our early Revelation studies, but I don't feel like it's fair for those that weren't here to just completely ignore this and say, go back and listen, go back and listen, go back and listen three or four times. So we're going to go through this all as if it's the first time. This phrase, the Son of Man, is a very interesting phrase. In early Old Testament scriptures, that phrase was used pretty commonly. And it applied to any who were born of mankind, anyone that had a human birth with human parents. So in that sense, we could say that we are all sons of men. I'm a son of man. You are a son of man, even if you're a woman. Figure that one out. And the Bible uses that phrase in that very common and general way, but all that you have to do is read verse 14, and it becomes pretty obvious that this verse is calling for a deeper meaning than that, because the one that we are learning about in this section isn't just a son of man, he is like the Son of Man. That is, he looks like an ordinary man. He looks like he was born of mankind. But of course, just look at what he does in the rest of these verses. What he does is not human-like. It is extraordinary. It is superhuman. It is supernatural. Namely, he descends out of heaven riding on a white cloud, or seated on a white cloud, I should say. So, that's about the time that we realize we really, what we need to do is track that phrase, the Son of Man, all throughout the Bible and watch its movement in order to see what we can learn. In the first 26 books of the Bible, the Old Testament, we see nothing peculiar about that phrase, even though it is used quite a bit. In the book of Ezekiel alone, the 26th book of the Bible, Ezekiel uses that phrase 85 times. And that's because that's just what the Lord calls the prophet Ezekiel. He calls him the Son of Man. So the first 26 books of the Bible, nothing pops up on our radar. And then we come to the 27th book in the Bible. That's the book of Daniel. And when Daniel uses this phrase, now we have movement with the phrase. We have a change. We have a shift. When Daniel uses this phrase, the Son of Man, he uses it prophetically as a prophetic messianic title. And here's what we first see. First mention, Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. Here's what Daniel says. Listen to this closely. No, I'm not rereading Revelation 14:14. This is Daniel 7:13. It says this, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Extremely similar to Revelation 14:14. Just compare the two, and you'll reach the proper conclusion. Both Daniel and John, they were both seeing this same vision. And here's the really cool thing about this. From Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 on, from that first time that Daniel applies this phrase as a prophetic messianic title, it is never tampered with again in the scriptures. It is never again used as an expression or a phrase to speak of an ordinary human being. It becomes exclusively a messianic title. It's like an unwritten rule that once Daniel assigned that phrase to be a messianic title, no one else wanted to come near it. So Daniel will use that phrase one more time in Daniel chapter 8, verse 17. He is once again referring it to the Messiah. And from that point forward, the remaining 12 books of the Old Testament, no one uses that phrase. It's not used again until when? Who was the first person to use it after Daniel used it prophetically and as a messianic title? That would be Jesus. Jesus in the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 8, verse 20, when Jesus was speaking about himself. And that became his favorite title to refer to himself with. And it incensed the unbelieving religious Jews because they knew what that title meant from Daniel 7:13 forward. They knew it was a title exclusively reserved for the Messiah. He knew what that title meant. He loved to use it. They knew what he meant. And eventually they wanted to kill him over it because to them it was blasphemy for him to adopt and embrace that messianic title. Indeed, it would have been had it not been true. So, the one like the Son of Man that we read about in Revelation 14, verse 14, is Jesus. And let me just point out the purpose for the wording. He's not just called the Son of Man or a Son of Man. He is like the Son of Man. What does that mean? That means he has retained his human-like appearance. He's not just the Son of Man. We know that. He's the Son of God too, but he has, at least in this appearing, retained his human-like, man-like appearance. And that shouldn't surprise us because we also know that he's going to retain even the scars that he received from crucifixion. The scriptures tell us that when the world sees him, they will see him as the one whom they pierced. They'll see him with the wounds, the scar prints in his hands and feet, the gaping hole in his side. So this is Jesus, like the Son of Man, truly the Son of God. And he's seated on a white cloud. Again, ground that we've already covered, but let's go back through it. The white cloud, what is it? Is it an atmospheric cloud? Stratus, cumulus, Sirius, nimbus. Is it an atmospheric cloud? Or is it that Old Testament cloud of glory, the Shekinah glory of God that was seen in the Old Testament tabernacle as a visible sign and symbol of God's presence there in the tabernacle? Or is it the cloud of witnesses that we read about in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1? Well, here's a question that will help us to decipher through some of that. Here's the big question. If this is an atmospheric cloud, or even if this is the Shekinah glory of God, the cloud of God's glory, as seen in the Old Testament tabernacle, then here's the big question. Where are we? Where's the church? Where's the believers? Where are the angels? Because Bible prophecy tells us that when Christ returns, that's not a solo trip. He brings us all with him. The scriptures tell us he has a host with him. And let me show you some of that in the Bible. First of all, from the book of Jude, chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. This is how Jude explains or describes the second coming of Christ. Jude, chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10 thousands of his saints to execute judgment on all. Add to that what Jesus said in Luke chapter 9, verse 26. Jesus said, "For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in his own glory and in his Father's and of the holy angel." So now you just add all of that together. This holds consistent throughout the Bible. I could show you a myriad of verses to support this, but add that all up. When Jesus returns, he is returning in his own glory. He is returning in the Father's glory. He is returning with the saints, and he is returning with the angels. Now, what are the chances that the Apostle John would see the return, the descent of Christ, and go like this? Billions and billions and billions of believers and angels. Funny, didn't notice you guys, didn't see you there. What are the chances of that? Impossible. So this cloud that we're reading about indeed is that heavenly cloud spoken about by Daniel in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. Now, you got the white cloud of God's presence, God's glory, God's Shekinah glory. You got the white robes of Christ. You've got the saints dressed in white robes of righteousness. You have brilliant white angels of light. That's a lot of white. So what would that look like from a great distance? That would look like a cloud. So no, it's not that John is wrong or incomplete. He's right. It's just that we have, through the scriptures, a more balanced and complete view of this. Conclusion, the white cloud is the illustration, but the cloud of God's glory and the cloud of witnesses is the full explanation. And there's a tiny bit more to it, isn't there? This vision shows Jesus seated on the cloud of witnesses, riding on the cloud. So this is for the purpose of conveying to us his authority and his victory, and also our exuberant support of this. You know what this is? Modern day terminology, here's what we call it. At a music concert, we would call it crowd surfing. Let me show you a picture of what this looks like. Throw that picture up there of crowd surfing. That's what this is. Now, I don't know who that goofball is, but this just gives you an idea. This is the picture that we're seeing. The saints and the angels supporting him as he's seated on the cloud of witnesses. And that really sets the scene for what is taking place here, doesn't it? What better way to celebrate what we've all been waiting for, the making of all things right, the abolishment, the destruction, the removal of all things ungodly, the setting of the world the way we've always wanted it, in perfect peace and righteous rule. What better way to set that tone and set that background than for Jesus to do a little crowd surfing, or if you prefer, cloud surfing. Now, this is, boy, tough crowd here today. Now, this, that 72 number crowd from last Easter, much easier. This isn't the first time he surfed either. This would be the second time. Jesus surfed in Matthew chapter 14, verse 25. You remember that. Now, they called it walking on water because he was surfing without a surfboard, but same thing. The Lord was surfing the water there. Here he's surfing the crowd. It's a wonderful scene, a wonderful moment. He will also be wearing a golden crown. But don't jump the gun here. Don't assume that you know what this means. We have talked before in a previous study, in our studies through Revelation chapter 1, about the two different kinds of crowns that we read about in the book of Revelation. Number one, there's the Stephanos, and that is not really so much a crown. It is a wreath or a garland that is made of laurel branches. That was something that was handed out when a person would win a competition in a Greek athletic game. That was a temporary crown or garland. Why? Well, number one, laurel branches are going to wither and they are going to die. That garland, that wreath, that Stephanos is not going to last forever. Second, the Greek athletic games continued on. There was always that next competition. So if you always wanted to have a Stephanos in your head, you had to constantly win at those athletic games. The second kind of crown, of course, the diadem. And that is the permanent crown. That is a kingly crown that is made out of the kingly metal, gold. Gold doesn't perish. It doesn't wither. So you might jump into this and read about this golden crown and assume that what we've seen from Christ in the past is true for this passage, that he's wearing a golden diadem, the kingly crown here, but he's not. He is wearing a golden Stephanos. Now, if you remember, in Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, when we first got introduced to the Antichrist, he was wearing a crown, and it was a Stephanos. It was a temporary crown that was going to eventually wither and dry up because that symbolized his rule would be temporary. He'd have 7 years, and then that was it. His crown would wither and fade. When we read about Christ early in the book of Revelation, we read of him wearing a golden diadem, a permanent crown that expressed his permanent rule. And now we read about Christ wearing a golden Stephanos. And there's more here than meets the eye. What that is communicating to us is that you have this crown made of metal, made of gold, but it is shaped in the form of a Stephanos. It is shaped in the form of laurel branches that comprise this garland, but it's not made of laurel branches. It's not going to wither. It's not going to fade because it's made of gold. And what that shows us is, yes, again, his permanent rule, but more importantly, it shows us that he has one. He didn't just have this handed to him. He didn't take it from the original owner by force, illegally. That what Christ did to wear this crown, he did by winning legally and rightfully and permanently this rule. And lastly, we see Jesus, the Son of Man, with a sharp sickle in his hand. What is the sharp sickle used for? Harvesting, of course. Reaping a harvest. But what is being harvested here? Try not to think back to the message title because that gives it away. What is being harvested here? We were told this by Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew when he gave to us the parable of the tares. That's found in Matthew chapter 13. Verses 24 through 30, and I want to read that to you. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' The servant said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' But he said, 'No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first, gather together the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" So people used to do this to sabotage the crops of neighbors that they didn't like. They would see that they had planted a wheat harvest, and they would go and sneak out there in the middle of the night and plant alongside those wheat seeds these tare seeds. We call it today bearded darnel. And it was really sneaky because it is not easy to tell the difference between tares, bearded darnel, and good wheat. There are very minimal differences between the two. The biggest difference, the most obvious difference, is that the tares, the bearded darnel, they are stiff and they do not bend with the wind. But the wheat, it is flexible. And so when the wind blows, the wheat blows with the wind. And if the wind bows the wheat to the earth, the wheat bows to the ground. That is a perfect comparison between the believer and the unbeliever. The unbeliever, when the wind of the Spirit is blowing, they are rigid, they are stiff-necked, they will not budge, they will not surrender to the direction of the Spirit. But the believer, the wheat, we go where the wind of the Spirit takes us, don't we? We do as the wind of the Spirit directs us. Another big difference is that wheat is edible and healthy, and bearded darnel is not. In fact, it can kill you, and it has killed. On occasions where bearded darnel got harvested and unnoticed with wheat, it has been known to kill humans and livestock. So unless you have someone go through a wheat harvest, just think about how ludicrous this is. Unless you have someone go through a wheat harvest and separate individual wheat from individual tares, if you have a major mix of tares and wheat, you pretty much just have to pitch the entire harvest. Only if you had someone who had the time to go through each one and say, okay, this is wheat, this is good, this goes to the barn, this is a tare, we're binding this up and burning it up. And watch this, the Lord has such a plan in place. We see him break down now in Matthew chapter 13, verses 37 through 43, this parable about this wheat harvest, this parable about the tares. Verses 37 through 43, he answered and said to them, speaking to his disciples, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. There's that messianic title again. The field is the world. The good seeds, the wheat, are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. Now, he's used billions and billions of people to help him with this, but he is always the source behind the sowing of these tares. Now, watch this. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so will it be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So that is a powerful parable that perfectly explains what we are studying in Revelation chapter 14, verses 14 through 20. It is the harvest at the end of the age. Now, this is not the very end of all things, but it's the end of the age. It's the end of the tribulation. It is the end of life on earth as we know it, before the Lord takes command. Verse 15, and another angel, this is another of the same kind of angels that we read about in verses 6 through 13. So another holy angel came out of the temple, the heavenly temple, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Ripe is from the Greek word zeraino, not oregano, zeraino. And most translations translate it as ripe. Some translate it as fully ripe. Some translate it as dry and dried up. And some translations, did I say overripe? A few translations translate it as overripe. Regardless of which translation you go with, I think personally fully ripe or overripe is a better translation. But whichever one you go with, here's the important thing you gotta pick up from the usage of that word. What that word is conveying to us is that the produce has reached the point where you seriously could not wait another day to pick it. I mean, it's now or never at this point. There is no more positive growth that is going to come from that produce. It needs reaped, and it needs reaped like today. The only thing left for this produce, this grain, this fruit of the earth, is to begin the process of decay. So it's going to begin to rot at this point. And the truth carried forward from that is an important truth, that the Lord waits as long as he can before he calls for the harvest. He will not hastily harvest the field of this world. I mean, it is going to be ripe, if not overripe, when the Lord finally makes this call. And that is so that no one will get to say, Lord, you were too presumptuous and premature with the reaping. You hastily harvested. If you'd have just given me a couple more days, maybe a few more weeks, I just know I would have blossomed into good fruit. But you didn't give me enough time. You stuck in the sickle too soon, too fast. Nope, absolutely an impossible statement. As we've been studying through the tribulation period, one thing should be clear by this point, that if someone makes it until this final day of the tribulation, if they have gone through all 7 years of the tribulation having resisted and rejected Christ, then what they have done is they have thousands of times over deliberately chosen to reject Christ and to be swooned off their feet by Antichrist. I mean, the Lord does not make this easy for the tribulation saints to go through the tribulation without fully knowing their options. I'll be honest, I wish that the Lord would be as upfront and open and clear as he is in the tribulation. I wish he would be that open, upfront, and clear with our present generation. It might not change anything, but I just wish he would. He's going to be so clear. He's going to make it so tough to resist and reject him, and yet we're going to come to the end of the 7 years when the fruit is ripe and coming to the point of overripe, and no one will be able to say, I just needed a little more time. No, the Lord gave you all sorts of time. He is all sorts of long-suffering. He is all sorts of patient that I just cannot fathom. It's because the Lord is so patient that evil persists in the world the way it does right now. If you're looking for answers, why is there so much bad that happens on the earth? Why is there so much evil? Why does this happen and why does that happen? It is because the Lord is not quick to thrust in the sickle and call for judgment. He is giving that tear, that jerk that's flipping you off on the highway, he's giving that person as many opportunities as he can because he loves them just like he loves you. And that harvest won't happen until it is well past time for that fruit to be harvested. Verse 16. So he who sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth and the earth was reaped, all the tares, any remaining wheat, all the wicked, all of the righteous, all cut down, that is, separated from that which historically gave them life on the earth itself and the elements. It's now time for a spiritual harvest, for spiritual destinations. And first of all, with this first illustration of the grain or wheat harvest, I want you to just notice where this illustration takes us and leaves us. It takes us and leaves us at the reaping, the cutting down of the harvest, okay? Verse 17, then another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. So Christ had a sickle. The second angel has a sickle. And now John is going to shift to a different illustration. We now leave the grain harvest illustration, and now we talk about the grape harvest in order to illustrate how the wicked are sifted and sorted from the righteous and then condemned. Now, the Lord could have stuck with the grain or wheat harvest in order to do this. That illustration holds true. He gave all of that to us in Matthew chapter 13. We know what that looks like with the grain illustration being used. It looks like this. The wheat are separated meticulously and carefully by the angels. The wheat is bound up and burned up. The tares, I hope that's not the case. The tares are bound up and burned up, and the wheat are gathered into his barn. But to tell that same story, the Lord now gives John a vision of a grape harvest, and it is eerily apropos. Why two harvest illustrations to tell us about one end time harvest? I think when you read about this grape harvest, you'll get it. I think you'll see why he switches up the illustration here to make a more powerful point about not just the cutting down, but about the sifting and the sorting of the wicked. Verse 18, and another angel came out from the altar, the heavenly altar, who had power over fire, just like Rob Steinbrecher on our fireside fellowship nights. He's our fire guy. Power over fire. This angel has power over fire. And he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle. He cries out to the second angel, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are, here's a better translation, fully ripe, if not overripe. So again, the first illustration, the grain and wheat harvest, was all about the cutting down. Christ took care of that himself. The second harvest, to tell the rest of this story, the grape harvest, is all about the sifting and sorting. And this task, according to this verse, falls to this second angel. You remember what we read in Matthew chapter 13, verses 41 and 42. It was only 20 minutes ago. Hopefully you remember. This is what Jesus said in the parable. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. So again, that illustration is repeated using a different harvest illustration. I should say the illustration of reaping is repeated using a different harvest illustration, just in order to show us the role of the holy angels primarily in the shifting and sorting of the wicked. No one slips through the cracks. No one flies under the radar and makes it in because they went to church and no one noticed that they were a tear. The angels root them out, every one of them. Verse 19, so the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. Now, when it comes to a grape harvest, the concern is different than the wheat harvest. The concern for the grape harvest isn't that someone came in and planted fake grapes. I don't know if that's a thing. It's not about that. With the grape harvest, the concern is this: what is the destiny of the grapes? What's one potential destiny or destination for a bunch of grapes? To eat them. Let's start with the easy one: to eat them. If that batch is designated for eating, then you don't destroy the grapes, do you? You gather them, you keep them, you put them in the fridge, you enjoy them. What's the second purpose, the second destination or usage for grapes? You guys said it. Greg, my man. For the making of wine. And if that batch of grapes is destined to be turned into wine, then what happens to the grapes? They get destroyed. You all know how an ancient wine press worked, right? They had a wine press that was cut into solid stone. Usually it was like a bowl that then had a channel that led down into a collection pool. And what they would do is they would take the grapes and they would throw them up there on the sides, and they would get in there with their bare feet. Sometimes they'd even wash their feet first. And they'd get in there and they'd trample the grapes. They would tread the wine press. They didn't use shoes, because if you use shoes, that was too much solid contact and it would squash the seeds of the grape, and that would produce too much tannin in the wine. Not a good thing. So they used the soft soles of their feet. By the way, I just learned this week and I posted it on Facebook. It might be helpful to you as well. Did you know that if you put socks and shoes on a bear, that it still has bare feet? Is that helpful to you too? It's amazing some of the things you'll learn here at Anchored Fellowship. But they would use the bare feet and they would trodden down, they would trample the wine press. The grapes were smashed and crushed and squeezed, and the juice would come out and collect in the collecting pool. And I think now you can begin to see why the Lord used this illustration for the sifting and sorting of the wicked. It's called the blood of grapes for a reason. It looks like blood. If you've ever seen a picture of a wine press after the grapes were trodden down and the wine press was treaded. I don't know if that's proper English, but I'm going to go with it. If you've ever seen what that picture looks like, it looks like a massacre. And that's exactly what this is, this end time harvest. It is going to be a massacre of the wicked. Again, don't think ill of the Lord. How many more choices? How many more chances? How many more opportunities could he give a Christ-rejecting wicked world than he does in the tribulation? He doesn't bring them to this. He doesn't desire this. The scriptures tell us God has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. But they have brought themselves to this massacre in the winepress of God's fury. Verse 20, and the winepress was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles, for 1,600 furlongs, or 180 miles. Now, I know we're running out of time here, but there are some important keywords in verse 20 that let us know that this end time event that John is seeing is the end time event known as the Battle of Armageddon. Where do we get that word from? Did we make it up? No, we didn't make it up. It's in Revelation chapter 16, verse 16. You can look at that for yourself later. At Christ's second coming, and we'll read this in Revelation chapter 19, Satan inspires the Antichrist to lead all armies against Christ. And here's where he brings them. at the second coming of Christ, somehow he convinces the world that's him. That's the reason for the tribulation. He's the one that's been trying to get you to come to him. He's the one that's been telling you his rule is coming. But if we come against him as a collective, unified army, if we overthrow him, the earth is ours. If not, we lose everything. And for some reason, armies will follow Antichrist, and he will lead them into the Valley of Megiddo, also known in the Bible as the Valley of Jezreel, also known in the Bible as the Valley of Decision, for the final battle at the end of the tribulation. Now, it's not the final battle. There's one after the 1,000 years, Revelation chapter 20. We'll get to that. But the final battle at the end of the tribulation is set for the Valley of Megiddo. Armageddon is a Hebrew word. It is a combination of two Hebrew words, har, which means hill, and Megiddo, which refers to the Valley of Megiddo. It is north. It's actually in the Samaria region. It is north of Jerusalem, north of Israel proper, below Galilee, right around there in the Samaria region. And it stretches from Mount Carmel all the way down to the alongside of, I forget the name of that mountain range. Anyway, right up to the brink or the bank of the Jordan River. It is, guess how long that valley is? 1,600 furlongs, or 180 miles, just as the scripture tells us. Armageddon means the hill of Armageddon. Can you go ahead and throw up that second picture, actually? Okay, no, that's good. That one right there. That's the one we want. This is a map rendering of the Jezreel Valley, or the Valley of Megiddo. As you can see, it starts at Mount Carmel. Mount Gilboa is the other one. It runs along here and right down to the mouth here where the Jordan River is. If you see here this little star where it says Megiddo, there's this unusual hill that pokes out. And it's sort of right there at the arm or the swivel of that entire Megiddo Valley. So Har Megiddo, the hill of Megiddo, it's sort of the central point of that entire valley. And it is an unusual sight. It is incredibly flat. Go ahead and show the other picture now. This is an actual photo of that area today, a modern day photo. You can see how flat it is. It is flat for 180 miles. It looks like a giant wine press. It is flat for 180 miles. On a clear day, you can see 50 miles in every direction. And what's so unique about this incredibly long and wide flat spot of land is that it is completely out of character with the topography, with the landscape of that region. It's just this spot. It looks like it was divinely created on the earth for the purpose of a great battle. And the history of that valley is just that. It is well known as a place of battle. When Napoleon Bonaparte seen the Valley of Megiddo for the first time, here's his words, and I quote, "Surely this must be the place where the last great battle is fought." And indeed, that is the truth. That is where this battle is going to take place. And I think we need to talk about one more thing before we close up. Can you give me 3 minutes? How about five? Seven? All right. I think what we need to talk about before we close is the volume of blood that is mentioned for this Valley of Megiddo during this Battle of Armageddon. The scripture told us that the blood would come out of the wine press, that is the Valley of Megiddo, up to the horse's bridle for 1,600 furlongs. Blood up to the horse's bridle. That's between, correct me if I'm wrong, 4 to 6 feet high, depending on the size of your horse. 4 to 6 feet high. Is it possible that that entire 180-mile valley could be covered in 4 to 6 feet of blood? Logically, I'm going to say no, that's not possible. So some speculate maybe this means that the blood from this intense battle will splash up as high as the bridle on the horse. And I'm not so sure about that. Here's what I see. I see the Valley of Megiddo serving, just as the Lord said, as a wine press. So my thinking is that this entire valley is going to be covered with blood, and the low spots that serve as a collection pool would for a wine press will be as high as 4 to 6 feet with the drain off of the blood from this battle. Now, how is that possible? I think it points to only one possible style of warfare for the Battle of Armageddon. Let me explain what I mean. Consider this. The more modern and technological our warfare becomes, the less deaths we see. Because the big prize in warfare, back before modern technological weapons, the big prize in warfare used to be kill as many soldiers as you can. The loss of life. That was the big prize in any military campaign. It's not that way anymore, is it? The big prize in military campaigns, the big prize in war is no longer how many people did you kill. The big prize in warfare is now this. Can we take out the missile silo? Can we wipe out that military base? Can we take out those factories where they're producing nuclear warheads? So the big target now, the big prize in warfare is not loss of life. It is the sabotaging or the destruction or the commandeering of military equipment. And let me just show you a proof of that real quick. In the Civil War, America's Civil War, 620,000 people lost their lives. Now, and you can follow this right through all of the wars that America was involved in. From the Korean War to Vietnam to World War I to World War II, if you add up the deaths of all those wars that were fought with modern technology, there's still more deaths in the American Civil War, more than all of those other wars combined. And hello, two of those were world wars. Let me try that again. World wars. And the other two were wars that at least involved multiple nations. Still more deaths in the American Civil War. Why is that? Because it wasn't modern warfare. It wasn't attacking equipment. It was hand-to-hand combat. So I'll leave you with this. Worship team, come on up. What a strange note to end on, I admit, but I leave you with this. I fully believe that the Battle of Armageddon, this post-tribulation judgment of God, most likely is not going to be fought with modern technological warfare. I suspect that by the time the tribulation has ended, that the tribulation will have so depleted the earth and wiped the earth out that I believe that this war, the Battle of Armageddon, will be hand-to-hand combat. The sword will be used, the bow and arrow. The horse will once again be used in battle. And hey, if I can say so, just give liberals more time. They'll get us there even quicker because those are two really big things on their no-no list, guns and anything that is fueled by fossil fuels like military equipment. I believe that's what it's going to come to. And I believe that's why you're going to see this level of bloodshed that you're going to see at the Battle of Armageddon in the Valley of Megiddo. Would you all stand with me? It's a somber note to end on, I understand that, but that's where we are in our passage. for you and I. Are we going to be at this judgment? Are we going to be at this harvest? Are we going to be at this sifting and sorting? Are we going to be present at the battle of Armageddon? Well, if so, it's not to fight against Christ. And this is not our fate. Our fate is to win. Our fate is victory because we chose the victor. If you haven't chose the victor, you should do that right now, today. You should settle this issue. You should put to ease this uneasiness about what's coming. You should do it right now, today, before you have a change of heart, before the enemy can plant some tares in your mind and tear you away from the truth and tear you away from what you really need. And that's the Lord. Let's pray.